today's webinar on the CERCLA 108B Financial Responsibilities Formula. While I pull up the presentation materials, I would like to get ready to turn things over to your first speaker today, and that's Richard Benware. Richard, are you ready to begin?
We are. Thanks, Jean. All right, so I'll echo what Jean said. Welcome, everyone, to CERCLA 108B Financial Responsibility Formula for Hard Rock Mining. This is our public webinar on the proposed rule. My name is Richard Benware, and I'll be presenting today. Our goal is to get through the slides and answer as many questions as possible, hopefully all of them. I will note at the outset, however, that we did some of our advanced questions were on very site-specific inquiries and how the rule would apply to a particular facility. And I will say that for those types of questions, we did not receive sufficient detail to be able to respond to those. And so for those questions, while we can point you to the correct regulatory text, we won't be able to answer them in full detail today. So just wanted to get out of the way at the start. So beginning here, we have a number of things we'd like to cover today. First, we're going to give you an overview of the formula. It comprises three pieces, the response component, natural resource damage component, health assessment component. Then we'll show you the full thing. We'll talk about the peer review, the comments we received and responses, the reductions, so how you can demonstrate alternatives to the financial responsibility. And then we have a tool, a new calculator that we've designed and posted, and we'll go through a short demonstration of that before taking questions. So first, the formula discussion you can find at 82 FR 3388 on page 3461. And if you take a look at that section, there's a number of components where we talk about information used to determine the amounts, development of the formula, inputs to the formula, reductions, et cetera. So this is where you can find them. And then here on slide 4, we have the formula in its entirety. So these are the individual pieces that we'll go through talking about one at a time. So we'll start with the response costs. So just to give people kind of guidance, if you're interested in looking into further detail, each of these slides at the top will say section 1 or section 2.2, et cetera. That's meant for you to direct yourself in the financial responsibility formula background document should you want more information, which section you can look to for that type of information. So here, this is the information presented in section 1 of that document. So as an overview, EPA sought a practicable approach that could account for a limited number of site-specific details, but that could also be applied nationwide. We propose the use of a national site-based financial responsibility formula to determine the financial responsibility amount for any particular facility. The formula we're considering is comprised of the following three components: a response component, a natural resource damage component, and a health assessment component, as we mentioned earlier. So here, the response component, you can see, is made of a number of categories. So starting in section 2.1 of the background document, EPA discussed CERCLA response costs. So here, EPA collected information on response costs from NPL sites, as well as non-NPL CERCLA hard rock mining facilities. We took information from records of decision, settlements, actual expenditures to date by EPA, and combined those to estimate the expenditures for present and future work by potential responsible parties. In addition, in section 2.2, EPA also looked at the response activities. So what was that money being spent on? EPA collected data on specific activities conducted at 438 operable units at 88 NPL or Superfund alternative hard rock mining sites. Using this data, EPA could link specific site features to releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances, as well as to remedies that incurred response costs. EPA found that 13 of these site features, such as tailings, served as the source of release that resulted in remedies with an initial list of 12 categories, such as water treatment. Now, in section 2.3 of the document, we had the task of trying to determine how we could scale this at any given site. EPA wanted to use not only the amounts of financial responsibility, but the individual response activities in 2.2. But what we found is that it was difficult to disaggregate the data into those specific response activities. So what EPA did is we linked response categories to current engineering cost estimates from reclamation closure plans. For example, EPA linked the remedy category of on-site disposal and engineering containment to current engineering cost estimates such as backfill, earthwork, revegetation, stormwater control, and source control, such as synthetic covers. And by making these linkages to current reclamation closure plan cost estimates, we were able to group tasks into 13 response categories for further analysis. So here are those 13 response categories. You'll see that they are broken out into two types of costs. We had both capital costs as well as operation and maintenance costs. Capital costs included capital costs at various site features such as open pits and underground mines, but also included some site-wide things such as drainage and solid and hazardous waste disposal. On operation and maintenance costs, we're focused on both short-term and long-term operations and maintenance. So this included both site-wide operation maintenance and monitoring, such as groundwater monitoring or fish tissue monitoring. But it also included such things such as interim O&M, which would include drain down or long-term water treatment. In Section 3 of the document, once we had these categories established, we were able to obtain a sample of 63 facilities reclamation and closure plan engineering cost estimates. These had data on capital and operations and maintenance costs, data on acreage of various site features, such as the acreage of the open pits, and water treatment flows. These sites were supplemented with three CERCLA sites contained in EPA's CERCLA site data set for additional water treatment cost data due to a shortage of sites that had ongoing water treatment or projected water treatment at this time. EPA also collected the following data from environmental impact statements or other publicly available documents. We collected things on water balance, such as precipitation or distance to water, as well as process method data, such as things like the use of cyanide leaching. Once this data was collected, EPA performed a response component regression analysis for each of these categories. In this analysis, EPA conducted a statistical regression to establish a numerical relationship between a limited number of facilities' site-specific characteristics and the resulting reclamation and closure plan costs. So essentially, EPA generated a subformula that results in expected financial responsibility amount for each response category on a nationwide basis. To do this, EPA selected a bidirectional elimination stepwise regression. We started with variables believed to be most significant and test the addition or deletion of individual variables from there. The results EPA attained generally confirm the significance of the variables that EPA expected to be predictive. To give an example, here is one of the line set plots, and you'll see on the x-axis the log acres of a tailings facility, and on the y-axis the log of the costs of that tailings facility. Here you'll see the blue points, for those of you on a colored screen, blue points representing the actual cost data and red the estimated through the bidirectional regression. And you can see that we had a pretty significant fit. So once we completed this, two of the response categories either did not obtain a statistical fit with any variables or did not have sufficient data to conduct regression analysis, and we've got those listed here. The first was the solid and hazardous waste disposal category, where we didn't have statistical fit, and the other was the slag piles, where we had only a single data point. Additionally, EPA annualized operations and maintenance costs from some regressions into a net present value. So if you recall from the earlier slide, those were the short and long-term operation and maintenance and monitoring, as well as the interim O&M and the long-term water treatment. So these four were discounted into a net present value based on the payment experience of the fund. And so here we used a 10-year short-term operation and maintenance period, a perpetual long-term operation and maintenance period, and a real discount rate of 2.63%. And these were based on the actual short and long-term operation and maintenance EPA has seen historically, as well as the real discount rates that the Superfund has returned its investments. So now moving on, we'll discuss another pair of components here, which are adjustments to those response costs, one for overhead and oversight, and one for state-specific adjustments. So EPA calculated overhead and oversight costs as a percent of direct engineering costs. So here we're talking about overhead costs, which would be comprised of things like mobilization, and that accounts for approximately an additional 36% of direct engineering costs, so just getting people there, the things that you need. And for oversight, we're talking about things such as agency contract management, so actually having the staff and capabilities to manage those contractors. And this differs based on the specific indirect rate for the EPA region, and EPA regularly publishes these rates, which were included in the background document. Additionally, to adjust for locality differences in the prices of labor and materials, The response component of the formula is also multiplied by the most current state cost adjustment factors in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Civil Works Construction Cost Index System. So once these adjustments are made to the response cost, EPA also estimated a natural resource damage multiplier. First, EPA collected information on natural resource damages from hard rock mining facilities through a number of sources, particularly mining court settlements and judgments, and records of voluntary natural resource damage payments. In total, EPA found 24 sites with both natural resource damages and response costs. From these sites, EPA calculated a multiplier that was estimated by taking the natural resource damages for those sites and dividing by the total response cost from those sites, which EPA calculated to be 13.4%. The next piece that EPA estimated was health assessment costs. For health assessment costs, EPA consulted with the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, or ATSDR. They provided EPA average, minimum, and maximum costs for their site health assessments from the most recent 18-month period. And most health assessments make use of EPA-collected data, and they require similar types of activities and reports. So generally, these types of costs are expected to be consistent across most facilities. For this reason, EPA used a fixed cost of $550,000 for all sites, which represents the average provided by ATSDR in that data set. So finally, the financial responsibility formula had a few adjustments. For instance, this formula is supposed to be re-estimated every 3 years, and so to not have to propose new rules every few years to adjust the numbers, EPA has an inflation adjustment, making use of the GDP deflator. In addition, EPA assumes the use of source controls and water treatment as a conservative assumption so that the formula will not underestimate costs of potential future site remediation. And since EPA assumed this use of source controls, to avoid double counting, EPA used those source controls to reduce the volumes of water calculated for water treatment. This was done to the use of field data from EPA's ACAP study, where they found that use of things such as synthetic covers would reduce percolation from annual precipitation to about 5% of the gross precipitation amount. And so further information, again, on this can be found in the background document, and we've presented the individual document ID number here, should you wish to consult it. So this is the formula. Now that we've gone through all the parts, we'll move on to the peer review. So an overview of the peer review is that EPA conducted a letter review through an independent contractor. There were four reviewers who had expertise in applied statistics and or econometrics, applied economics or policy analysis, and knowledge of one or more of the following, including hard rock mining processes, general principles behind estimating environmental damages, CERCLA actions and Superfund sites, and or experience studying releases of hazardous substances and working with data on response and remediation costs and natural resource damages. EPA submitted the background document for peer review in mid-September, and the compilation of peer review materials and comments has been placed in the proposed rule docket, and here's the document ID number for that should you wish to read it. The charges that we submitted to the peer reviewers, there were six charges. First, we saw an overall assessment of the appropriateness of the underlying methodology. Second, we asked for recommendations that might improve the soundness and transparency of the document. Third, we were looking for the appropriateness of or supplemental data to the response activities that we collected. Fourth, improvements to the standardization and other pre-analysis data steps. Five, linkages to response categories and or additional site features the EPA should have included. And finally, the statistical models chosen and the robustness of our analyses. Based on those charges, peer reviewers did provide comment in a number of areas, which I've been here into five main categories. The first of which is data collection, where we received comments from peer reviewers on things such as the sample representativeness, the quality assurance and quality control of the individual data points, accuracy of underlying estimates in the state reclamation and closure plans, and additional cost data and cost categories EPA might consider. Under the second category, response component analysis, EPA received comments on suggested uses of actual cost data from CERCLA sites, the log normality treatment of the data as EPA used it, the stepwise regression process, the analysis of influential points, and the robustness and reasonableness of the estimates. Under the third category, natural resource damage component analysis, EPA received comments on data sources as well as estimation methodology. For the fourth category, adjustments in use, EPA received comments on source control assumptions and alternatives they might consider, state and regional differences in cost estimates, adjustments over time, and suggestions for additional adjustments. And finally, EPA received a number of comments on documentation and other miscellaneous issues. So here we had comments on, for instance, transparency issues, text edits, overarching comments to the whole document, and some miscellaneous things. So EPA also drafted, in response to these comments, a draft response to comments document. We will note that the peer review generally supported EPA's methodology, though there were many recommendations in there. Many of the comments that we did receive resulted from documentation or transparency issues, which EPA intends to correct in the final formula background document. EPA performed several additional analyses in this document, in the response to comments document, as suggested by peer reviewers, and as a result, we're considering changes to the formula as discussed in the proposed rule preamble. Amongst them, two of the larger ones are alternatives to the natural resource damage multipliers, as well as to the alternatives to the assumption of source controls at individual site features. If you would like to read this draft response to comments document, you can find it in the docket with this docket ID number. Finally, we'd like to talk about reductions a little bit today. Our rule was intended in part to provide incentives for practices that decrease the need for future CERCLA actions. So it's meant to be not just a financial responsibility rule, but also an incentive-creating rule. Here, EPA desires to account for risk-reducing effects of compliance with other programs. In particular, the rule proposes under 320.63C to allow but not require owners or operators to reduce the response cost component of the financial responsibility formula by making an adequate demonstration that risk-reducing regulatory requirements are in place. To satisfy this section, an owner or operator must demonstrate the following four things. First, evidence that the owner or operator is subject to the requirements. Second, evidence that the owner or operator's obligation to implement these requirements are imposed in an enforceable document. Third, evidence that the owner or operator has demonstrated and is required to demonstrate adequate financial responsibility to assure implementation of the required activities. And finally, certification by the owner or operator that the facility is in compliance with these requirements. Owners and operators that meet these criteria for the formula would not have to calculate financial responsibility for that component. The rationale for inclusion of specific requirements is presented in a technical support document available in the docket, and here we've presented you with the docket ID number for that, should you choose to go read it. In addition, EPA solicited comment on whether the rule should also allow for EPA to conduct a programmatic review of other regulatory requirements and their implementation, with the objective of determining whether the reduction criteria met across the program in question. Such a program deferral approach would provide for programmatic-based reductions in situations where the program meets the requirements for deferral of CERCLA Section 108B requirements for the full response component of the formula. So that is all facilities, all response categories, just the full formula could be deferred at particular programs. Under this approach, owners and operators would not be required to comply with the requirements to calculate a financial responsibility amount and to obtain a financial responsibility instrument under EPA's 108B regulations after EPA determines that a state or federal program meets those criteria. EPA also solicited comment on an alternative to that where we would consider partial deferral from the response component of the formula where a federal or state program met the criteria for deferral for some but not all of those 13 response categories. So again, EPA solicited comments on these alternatives. And at this point, we've received a number of questions and comments from the public saying, how do we use this format? How do we implement it? Could you guys create a tool? So EPA is posted, and it's available to you today through the Kulin webinar website, which Gene will refresh at the end, a financial responsibility calculator. And so here we're going to give you guys a quick overview and demonstration of how it works. And we just want to note up front that, in fact, this calculator is a tool meant to assist you in implementing the regulation as written in the current regulatory text and is not meant to substitute or replace anything in that text. So the calculator starts with an instructions page describing the general information that you're required to fill out and how. In specific, it lists 15 user input tabs. These user input tabs include general information, response component inputs, and then 13 individual tabs for filling out the reduction criteria. Here is an example of the response input component input. You'll see that here is where you would enter various disturbed acreages and other information, such as water treatment flows, what EPA region you're in. And then here we have an example page for one of the performance criteria where you'd say whether you had evidence that you're subject to requirements, an enforceable document, adequate financial responsibility, and your certification that you're in compliance. And so there would be an individual tab for each one of these. You can see at the bottom. And finally, it will spit out a initial amount, whether or not you met the reductions, and the final formula amount on a detailed response component tab. And finally, a summary tab where you can see what your response component, natural resource damages component, and health assessment component are to determine your full financial responsibility amount. So at this point, we'd like to take individual questions. We've already had some submitted during this webinar as well as some in advance. We'll start with the ones that came to us first and were in advance, and we'll work our way through, again, trying to get to as many of these as possible. I will remind you that we probably will not be able to answer a number of the site-specific questions in this forum due to lack of information provided. But we ask that you do, if you're submitting questions, please make the context of your question clear. If you feel that you can do that by including slide numbers, topic names, specific pages, or information from our documents, the more specific, the better we'll be able to answer them. So, we're going to go to our responding to questions now, but if you do have comments on the proposed rule, we remind you to submit them through the docket by March 13th at this docket ID number. Okay, so first set of questions that we have received ahead of time, questions on formula development. We had a question, in calculating financial responsibility, should the owner or operator use quarterly figures or annual figures for the implicit price deflator or gross domestic product? As seen in the equation in section 320.63, EPA is the unitation deflator sub Y star. This indicates that the quarterly figures should be used until a new annual figure is available. Another question, what were other sources of cost information considered besides the engineering cost data based on state and federal mine closure and reclamation plans? As discussed in section 2.2 of the formula background document, EPA examined historical response costs but was unable to disaggregate these costs by category. As a result, EPA used cost estimates from reclamation and closure plans with similar activities as a proxy for CERCLA response costs. How do the site features on which the state and federal closure and reclamation plans are based and used in the engineering cost estimates relate to the site features that require response actions and past cleanups, and is there a crosswalk EPA has developed for this purpose? Table 2.2, or 2-2 in section 2.3 of the formula background document actually shows how EPA linked the remedies to site features in the reclamation closure plans. So these site features align very closely with those seen in past cleanups, as seen in section 2.2.1 of the background document. Particularly, I would note that questioner to figure 2-6. Another question, what other statistical techniques, if any, were considered besides bidirectional elimination, stepwise linear regression, and what variables besides disturbed acreage used in the regression analysis, were any of these variables considered reflecting the need for source controls? So section 4.1.1 of the formula background document discusses alternative stepwise regression techniques EPA considered, and section 4.1.3 discusses both the starting suite of variables that EPA used as well as the additional variables that EPA considered during the stepwise process. So in other words, the ones that we tested for significance. Variables indicating distance to ground and surface water as well as the use of process chemicals may be linked to the need for source controls. However, EPA did not perform any analyses specifically linking those variables to source control usage. Another question, was any consideration given in this methodology of the possibility of overestimating financial assurance because each of the 13 site features are considered separately? Specifically, the other approach would be to design a mine site to the standards required by closure and reclamation plans, which would allow economies of scale to be realized. So EPA believes that separately estimating FR for each site feature is appropriate for several reasons. First, these costs are estimated separately in all other contexts, whether you're talking about Superfund RIFS, the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study process, to reclamation closure plans at state or federal level. Second, just looking at the data, there's a significant correlation between the sizes of various site features. Thus, regressions using site-wide costs would likely have multicollinearity issues. And third, a formula that developed all costs simultaneously would preclude EPA from allowing facilities to partially reduce that FR amount where reduction requirements for individual site features were present. And then finally, we also note that one of the peer reviewers presented the exact opposite premise from the question, saying that EPA will note in looking at the source documents that engineers use constant average costs when calculating the response costs, and therefore no economies of scales are present in the source data. So in general, EPA finds that the feature-specific process we use is appropriate. And, you know, if you have comment on that process, you know, please submit it to the docket as indicated before. Another question, was any truthing exercise done by applying regression equation to sites where response costs were undertaken to determine how closely they predicted actual response costs? Similarly, another questioner said, does EPA have a data quality standard against which to measure the accuracy of the predicted financial assurance amounts? If so, what was the result of the review of that data against the standard? So EPA did not apply the formula to CERCLA sites prior to this proposal. However, we did receive peer review comment on it. And so in our response to comments document, we stated EPA will conduct a validation on a number of CERCLA sites where response costs have been incurred across site features such as Summitville Mine. So EPA is going to take a look at it, and we're going to attempt to run a few validations of this in response to the peer reviewer's comments. Another question, given that human health risk requires an exposure pathway, was the location proximity to population centers or the lack of proximity to population centers considered? If so, how was it factored in? So EPA considered several variables that account for proximity of media, such as groundwater depth and surface water distance, which would ultimately affect human and ecological receptors. The regressions generally did not show significance to these variables. And, you know, to the extent that the commenter here is referring to the types of characteristics used for human-specific receptors, we did not examine any other proximity to human receptors. Another question, will EPA provide a tool based on the formula which calculates the amounts? Yes, so that's the calculator, and again, Gene will be providing you guys information, and you should already have access to the Cluin site. And so on that Cluin site, if you look at the related links page, which she's pointed out earlier, you'll find the slides for this webinar, the calculator, as well as other resources. In particular, we also got a question about the calculator, suggesting that EPA calculates financial responsibility differently there than in the proposed rule regulation. We'll note that although it may be laid out differently so that people can see the cost of individual components, the individual multiplication, subtraction, addition, and other calculations were all done consistently with the regulatory text, and that, again, should any differences be noted, the regulatory text does govern. We received another question, interim O&M and monitoring category. Further details on how this is calculated is needed. So for further details on the generation of the various response categories, you can find in Section 4 of the background document. In addition, the relevant appendices will have the final response regression information. But to assist in calculating the financial responsibility, the calculator that we've discussed here at the end of the webinar does have the calculations for that, and so hopefully that will alleviate the difficulty this questioner was experiencing. Another question, historic Phoenix Mine had an unusually high open pit financial assurance cost, cost roughly 100 times the median open pit reclamation and closure cost used in the EPA regressions. This resulted from the closure plan requiring $223 million to backfill the pit. A reviewer suggested that this was a highly influential point and should be addressed separately. Would it be better to omit this point from the analysis, and what is EPA's current view on how to address this influential point or whether this point is influential? So, in the log format which EPA used, this data point was in fact not an outlier and as such did not warrant exclusion during the regression analysis. Furthermore, the test the peer reviewer, this specific peer reviewer suggested, showed that this data point was only influential but one but not both of the variables in the regression. However, EPA did discover three influential points in other regressions as a result of the peer reviewer's suggested analysis. And so page 82 FR 3463 states that EPA solicits comment on the influence points Continental and Chino mines for the interim O&M regressions and Phoenix Copper for the water treatment regressions. And so we do solicit comment on whether or not those points are outliers or should be addressed differently. And so if you do have comments in that vein, we do suggest you make them to the docket as discussed earlier. We received a number of questions on definitions. Again, for the most part, questions on the applicability of the rule to specific sites were not provided in sufficient detail for EPA to respond to today. However, we will touch upon where you can find specific definitions and what those definitions are, just for ease of commenting on the rule, and we do suggest that where you feel more clarity is warranted, you do give us comment there. So here, we have some questions over disturbed acreage and what is it? We have one question, will it vary over time based on development or reclamation, and can it be adjusted over time? Another one that says that the nomenclature in the formula indicates only disturbed acres to be included, and so they ask to confirm that disturbed acres are what's entered in the formula. That's correct. Both of those questions correctly point out that the formula inputs include only disturbed acreage. So since disturbed acreage can change over time, you'll note that in our rule we do propose a 3-year time frame for recalculating your financial responsibility amount. And in the preamble, we solicited comment on the appropriateness of that 3-year period. So if you do find that an alternative amount might be more warranted or that there's some alternative way of addressing these changes over time, we do suggest you provide us comment. Another set of questions. Would a closed feature in active mine be excluded from the calculation? This also relates to the authorized to operate language mentioned above. And another question that the proposed rule states that the rule only applies to facilities that are authorized to operate or should be authorized to operate. Does this include any mine under a permit? They provide some examples. And must financial responsibility be calculated for this facility? Again, EPA doesn't have sufficient details on the specific facilities that are mentioned here to determine whether these mines and site features would be authorized to operate and then subject to the rule. However, we'll point you to section 360.61, which explicitly states owners and operators of hard rock mining facilities that are authorized to operate or should be authorized to operate, and that it's that language that governs. So please do look at the language in 360.61. Is stockpiled ore or topsoil considered waste rock for the purposes of applying the formula? A similar question, is overburden or waste rock used to construct temporary roads considered to be waste rock? And under the definition of waste rock, what is intended by other features? So here I'll point the questioners to definition in 320.62, which states waste rock means waste rock and overburden piles, dumps, and other features associated with run-of-mine disposal of waste on the surface, whether from open pit or underground mines. Another set of questions, would a backfilled pit be included as pit acres or waste dump acres? Does the extent of backfilling matter? If an open pit is partially completely filled with waste rock, is that feature treated as an open pit or waste rock for purposes of applying the formula? So here we acknowledge that waste rock can be, in practice, placed into an open pit as backfill or alternatively co-disposed with tailings. Although such placement can have a beneficial effect, we don't believe that such placement would alter the nature or character of that open pit or tailings facility to an extent that it would behave more like a waste rock pile for the purpose of the cost formula. And you'll see this in the actual application in the background document, how EPA treated various site features. Another question, does a tailings facility include remote infrastructure areas? Tailings facility is defined in 320.62 of the proposed rule to mean ponds, dams, and other facilities including spillways and associated features used for the deposition of processed beneficiary waste or tailings from either pulp or vat leaching, flotation, or gravity processing facilities. This also includes paste or dry stacks. So again, I point you to that definition in B1V. Does a process pond include stormwater retention pond that receives runoff from the exterior area? Does process pond include a retention recycling pond for non-contact cooling water? Does it include a pond that does not receive process water from processing operations but does receive washdown water? We had a number of questions in this vein asking about specific definition of process ponds and reservoirs. And so, again, I'll point the questioners here to the definition in 320.62, and that states that a process pond or reservoir means process ponds, reservoirs, impoundments, ditches, channels, or other wet acreage that were used in heap leach, dump leach, metal or mineral processing, and other activities that have resulted in deposits of sludge and other potentially toxic and/or hazardous materials within those features. Another question, is process beneficiation waste the same as tailings in the definition of tailings facility? And if a pond receives mineral processing waste from a facility that's different from the mill where the tailings are leached, is the pond at the mineral processing facility a tailings pond? So again, here I'll point you to the specific, there's two definitions that are relevant here. I'd point you in 320.62. The first is tailings, which means the remaining waste material following the removal of valuable minerals from ore, and tailings facility, which is defined as ponds, dams, and other facilities, including spillways and associated features used for the deposition of process beneficiation waste or tailings from either pulp or vat leaching, flotation, or gravity processing facilities. We have some questions on what's considered disturbed acreage. Is the acreage identified with each site feature disturbed acreage, contributing to the total? Are government-owned roads crossing a mine site considered disturbed acreage? We have a number of questions down this line about what is considered disturbed acreage. Again, we point to the definitions in Section 320.62. There we define disturbed acreage as the area of land or surface water that has been altered for purposes of accommodating mining and or processing activities. The term includes the area from which the overburden, tailings, waste materials, or targeted minerals have been removed or placed, and areas where tailings, ponds, waste dumps, roads, conveyor systems, loadout facilities, heap leach, dump leach, ponds and impoundments, slag, and other mineral processing waste, and all similar excavations or placements that result from the operation are located. Now we have a couple questions on the net precipitation and precipitation terms. The first is, if a facility has a negative net precipitation, should that value or zero be entered in the formula? And on a similar vein, does precipitation in 320.63B1VII mean net precipitation is used in the other formula? So here, although we don't explicitly state it in the definition of 320.62, net precipitation can inherently be negative. So in those kind of instances, you should enter the negative value as you calculate it, as defined. With respect to precipitation versus net precipitation, these are correctly intended to be used as we stated them. So EPRI presumes the commenter is referring to the calculations of B1XIII for water treatment flows. And so here, as we discussed in the formula background document touched on in the webinar today, the water treatment flows calculation was developed using the findings of the ACAP study on covers and found that on average 5% of gross precipitation would percolate through those covers. So there we are talking, in fact, about gross precipitation rather than net precipitation. So the questioner is correct in noting that in that difference there. Another question, if a renewal permit is issued for a term of years, such as 5 years, and imposes the requirements necessary for reductions, is that an enforceable document? I think these types of questions you should refer to 320.4, where EPA defines enforceable document as a document issued under a federal, state, tribal, or local government authority to which the owner or operator is currently subject, and the requirements of which can be enforced against the owner or operator by the issuing authority. An enforceable document can be a permit, a settlement, an order, or any other document that meets the above criteria. We also received some questions in advance about alternative financial responsibility demonstrations. One question was, what is meant by the required activities in 32063C1 sub III? Here, the required activities refer to the requirements in 32063D. So we made that explicit reference both for subpart I and subpart IV, but we did not explicitly state that reference for subpart III, but it is intended to also refer to subpart D. Does 320C require calculation of separate financial responsibility amount for each feature category? We had a number down this vein, including please confirm that all facilities of the same facility category are considered collectively for the purposes of evaluating reductions. And please confirm that all acreage for single category facilities should be added together in a single entry of the formula. So these are all correct. As we stated in the preamble, all site features of the same type are considered collectively. In order to complete the formula, you'll see 320.63B1 requires the calculation of the financial responsibility for each of those response categories. And then when making a demonstration under subpart C, an owner or operator satisfies the requirement for that respective response category only. And so you would need to make that demonstration for each of the 13 response categories. Another question, for purposes of 32063C, provisions relating to other effective methods of preventing public access, livestock, they mentioned a number of things. Are other methods acceptable? And here, you know, we don't have the specific information to make that determination on a site-specific basis. And so, you know, that's something that if you do have questions on, it would be worth including in your comments on the proposed rule. Another question, is an improved closure plan sufficient to meet the requirements for disposal? Again, as we stated before, the closure plan could be sufficient if it meets the four requirements that we laid out in the webinar today. And those four requirements, you know, again, are that you have are subject to requirements, that they're included in an enforceable document, you have adequate FR in place, and you are currently in compliance. And specifically with respect to the requirements for disposal, subpart 8 here, you'll see that there's three individual requirements that EPA requires. We have requirements for disposal of all solid and hazardous waste in a manner that is protective of human health and the environment and that is in compliance with all applicable federal, state, and local requirements. Subpart II, requirements for contaminated soil disposal in a manner that is protective of human health and the environment and that is in compliance with all applicable federal, state, and local requirements. And subpart III, which is requirements to decontaminate buildings and structures to remove and safely dispose of hazardous substances. So if you had an approved closure plan that did those things and you satisfy the other requirements for achieving the reduction, then you could, in fact, claim it. For reductions for open pits, can the phrase where ponding will occur be answered in the negative, thereby satisfying this requirement? If a facility is subject to a regulatory requirement to minimize ponding by grading and or promoting free drainage. This is correct. There are, although these are nationwide requirements, there are places where you can answer some of these things in the negative. And again, if you have comments on how those behave, we do suggest that you submit those to our docket. For reductions requiring referencing a specific static factor of safety, must the specific factor of safety be required by an enforceable document, or is it sufficient that the document require more general safety criteria? This is a great question. So for the specific facility at issue here, we don't have sufficient information to answer the question. But we will note that it would probably depend on the facts at issue, and so you could see where the actual permit itself said that they have to have an adequate factor of safety, but then in the approved plan, which is also an enforceable document, perhaps they had the specific factor of safety in that. And so you can see that there could be a combination of enforceable documents that might be relevant here. So we can't answer the question for the specific facility, but we do refer you back to the definition of enforceable document there. How are the environmental settings which impact risk addressed in EPA's formulaic approach? A facility without acid-generating rock or a large depth of groundwater will pose less risk. How is that accounted for in the formula or cost reduction criteria? So some of you may recall from previous webinars hosted by EPA that constituent leaching potential or acid generating potential was considered as a factor for reducing FR, and that depth to groundwater and some of these proximity variables were in fact used in the regressions performed here. Under our current approach, we are relying on enforceable standards rather than the individual characteristics, and so we've incorporated this to some extent through the reduction criteria, and I'll give you an example from open pits where we state, this facility has a plan that demonstrates geochemically active materials will effectively be avoided, and that includes provisions for sampling and monitoring documentation. So you can see there that we do give credit where you've come up with a plan to demonstrate that you've avoided those geochemically active materials, and we do allow you to get a reduction based on it. So yes, we do account for that, and I guess is the short answer to that question. So those were our questions that we received in advance. At this point, we're going to now get into questions that we've received here on the webinar. We have some more formula questions that have come in. First, will the response to questions discussed during the webinar that you're going to be through available in a document? I think the answer is no. The responses here today will be in the recording of the webinar, but we don't intend to post them anywhere in a written form. Another question, will the formula be applied to existing bonds? I'm not sure what this question is exactly referring to. This formula will be applied to facilities as stated in the preamble for proposed rule. And so if a facility is subject to the rule, they would have to fill out the formula in 63 subpart B1. When developing the formula, how did EPA differentiate between small acreage sizes with high remediation costs, i.e. legacy gold mining, with large acreage sites with limited features that would be subject to CERCLA liability? So here I will note a few things. EPA does include acreage in the regressions that were run. With respect to the historical versus versus current facilities, I think they're getting to here. You can see how we deal with historical data in sections 2.1, 2.2 of the document, essentially looking at historical response costs from CERCLA sites, as well as the types of activity that we paid for at those sites. And then in 2.3, we link it to current sites today and what is being done today that's the equivalent of things that were being done in the past. And so there we looked at the costs from state reclamation and closure plans. And so, again, I'll reference you to the formula background document, specifically section 2.1 through 2.3 for the answer to that question. Another question, many of the facilities used were in place prior to the 1960s and any environmental rules. How do you think these sites skewed the financial assurance calculations? Again, we didn't, to the extent that the commenter is referring to the facilities in our currently operating data set, those facilities are currently permitted to operate, right? So unlike the historical sites that were abandoned prior to Superfund action and that we're looking at in 2.1 and 2.2, the facilities that we collect the data on that are currently operating are all permitted, and so, you know, they would be representative of the types of things that we would expect today. How would a facility deal with overlap? As a general example, if a facility did open pit mining with ongoing reclamation, is an open pit being filled with waste rock calculated as open pit or waste rock disturbed acres? As we mentioned before, this is an open pit, continues to be an open pit for purposes of the formula until it meets the criteria for being for coming out of subject to the being subject to the rule. Another question, if precipitation in a site is negative, why is there an assumption that there will be 5% percolation across the board? Doesn't this overstate percolation at some sites and risk understating percolation at others? That is possible. The use of an average is always going to be the best approximator across the board, but I will say that the data that EPA used from its ACAP program, if you go and look at it, there were separate data sets, both of which had about a 5% average, and the combined data set was also 5% average. And so while it is possible that any given site, the actual in practice percolation could be more or less than 5%, that for a nationwide formula, this would be relatively accurate. Another question, if a mine does not have acid-generating rock, should it should pose lesser risk. How is this accounted for in the formula? I think we mentioned before in one of our earlier questions that the ones that have plans that avoid acid-generating rock can, in fact, qualify for that part of the reduction, and I gave the example from the open pit. And so, again, you know, I advise everyone to look closely at the reductions and how they're defined currently and comment on those reductions as written. Are response costs used anywhere in formula development? So, yes, response costs we did use in both developing the natural resource damage multiplier and initially in figuring out, you know, where to start on the response component. So although we ultimately had to rely on the more disaggregated state reclamation and closure plan amounts, as we stated in Section 2.3 of the background document, you know, we did ultimately use those amounts in the natural resource damages multipliers. Another question, why has the NRD multiplier been separated from the total financial responsibility calculation as opposed to the formula presented in the documentation? Subtotaling the overhead and state multiplier into a response component total and then applying NRD multiplier to that total is inconsistent to the formula and increases by total cost as much as 15%. That's actually not accurate. The questioner here, using the distributive property, if you were to calculate all of the multipliers within the response component and then multiply that by the natural resource damage multiplier, it'd be the equivalent of having them all outside of the bracketed parentheses and multiplying them as well. So I think it's a misunderstanding. Either way, the response component is multiplied by 13.4% to generate the natural resource damage component, and all we've done in the calculator is break that out so that you can see what that component results in. At this point, we have some additional questions on definitions and reductions, and so I'm going to turn it over to one of my cohorts here, Mike Doyle.
Just a quick reminder, while we're waiting for our next speaker to come up on the line, you can submit your questions, comments, as well as report technical difficulties at any time using the Q&A window, which appears towards the middle right of your screen. As noted, we do have a number of links, including the calculator that was highlighted earlier, available on the middle right under the related URLs box. You can click on those links and press the Browse to button to open up any of those links of interest. And as stated earlier, the presentation slides will be posted shortly at the conclusion of today's live broadcast, so we'll be sharing that link with you all shortly as soon as we're done here today.
Okay, so actually the remaining questions that we have on reductions and definitions are very site-specific, and we don't have sufficient detail to answer them at this time. So I think we are just going to recommend that you guys identify these areas you believe to be ambiguous and include these concerns in your comments on the proposed rule. And again, we provided the docket number, and they're due by March 13th. So at this point, given that these remaining questions are very site-specific in nature and we can't answer them, we're going to turn it back to Gene to let you guys know how to access the various documentation, such as the calculator and everything else. So take it away, Gene.
All right. Thank you so very much. Let me walk through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. I'm going to start with the number one question that I received on the back end. And again, the seminar presentation slides are going to be available actually now. I'm going to share a link with everybody in the Q&A box. You'll find them on the seminar homepage as well. If you click on the tabs that are available, there'll be a tab on the seminar homepage for links or slides. You can click on that tab and you'll find the slides posted there as well. But in the meantime, we have a direct link to them in the Q&A window. window. We'll also add that in under the related URLs box that you see on the middle right of your screen. I want to just walk through a few final reminders for today's session. There were other resources which were discussed on today's webinar, including some websites and the calculator. Those were also posted under the related URLs box and are available on the seminar homepage. We do get questions asking for participation certificates, and while we do not offer CEUs for these webinars or PDHs, you can download or print out a participation certificate after you provide feedback for today's webinar, and you may be able to use that as part of your documentation to earn credit with your own institution for participating in today's webinar. So be sure to fill out the short online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session. Check the box at the bottom of that form to ensure that one of these certificates will be made available to you. As noted, there are resources that are currently available on the seminar homepage and under the related URLs box. I encourage you to browse through those, and those links will be available from this point forward. Additional information about the webinar will be shared on that site as it becomes available. Again, if you share the line with multiple people in the line, you can each fill out that short online feedback form. So if you fill it out, there's a box you can also check once you're done to have the next person in your location fill out that form. And the form will be available from this point forward. So if you need to step away and come back tomorrow, you're certainly welcome to fill that form out. As noted, today's live broadcast was recorded, and as soon as that archived webinar is available for free replay, we'll share the information with those of you who registered for today's session. So again, thank you all so very much for joining us for today's live broadcast.